Welcome to the Badlands, that overlooked place where philosophical thought runs into the political concerns of the day.
Hello and welcome to the Badlands Politics and Philosophy Podcast. I'm Toby Napolitano, and with me this fine, glorious week, Michael Hughes. How's it going, Michael?
Would we say that? I mean, I guess that's fine. You can be optimistic.
I actually wasn't. I was being purely sarcastic, but I guess maybe there is some cause for optimism. We're sitting here on a Thursday, still waiting for, obviously, the results of the presidential election. Still unclear in several crucial states, which will decide the election.
Yep.
I have to say, you know, early on, I know you felt this way too, early on in the election, like when Biden was losing Florida, there was a real like, oh shit moment. But I have to say, I was physically and mentally far less affected because I'm now numb inside and I'm not used to having the possibility of good things anyways. So I wasn't nearly as affected.
I think the effect that you're describing was most noticeable for me when Trump came out and gave his speech later on, where he effectively declared himself the victor. And I know that 4 years ago, if I had heard that exact same speech, I would have had a very different, much more adverse reaction. And it probably would have been like crippling stress and anxiety. But instead, I kind of just accepted it as, of course, that's how that went.
Yeah, that's pretty normal. So anyways, that's been a lot of fun. We look forward to hearing the outcomes of that. And today, just by way of distraction, we're going to discuss whether the ontological status of numbers, mathematical objects. I'm kidding. We're not going to talk about that. Instead, we're going to talk about something that is somewhat relevant to the election, which is some of the recent Supreme Court decisions concerning mail-in ballots and the election rules concerning mail-in ballots. For those who aren't aware, there was quite a lot of, or many cases concerning these, a lot of controversy. In some cases, the Supreme Court permitted extensions of deadlines for receiving mail-in ballots. In other cases, they didn't. And so we kind of wanted to go through some of these cases to try to figure out what exactly is going on.
To be clear, we're not just here to do a retrospective of the court's decisions on some of the cases that regarding longer grace periods and changes to deadlines in various states. We need to talk about this for a couple of reasons. First, it's still potentially relevant to the outcome of the election, right? We know that,
especially in the case of Pennsylvania.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of ways that the voting could turn out where it could be rendered irrelevant, but suppose that Trump were to make comebacks in all the states except for Pennsylvania, then the election ultimately could turn on the court's ruling regarding the grace period in Pennsylvania. In addition to, you know, wanting to go over this for the sake of just kind of trying to understand the way that our electoral process works, there's also some interesting philosophical questions about the political legitimacy of the outcome, right? And whether or not people's right to vote is actually, you know, being ensured through the processes that are currently being fought over within the court.
Okay, so maybe we should start filling in the background a little bit so people have, especially, you know, listeners who aren't from America, have a sort of better idea of the context and what's going on here. So obviously this is a special issue, this election, because of the pandemic, and thus the risk and the difficulty in doing in-person voting and people's reasonable desire to vote in ways that don't put them at risk of getting COVID, right? And so lots of states have adjusted their election rules to accommodate this. And in particular, there's been a massive increase in mail-in voting, right? So people can get their ballots ahead of time and then either drop them off somewhere at any, usually a couple weeks up to the election at least, or mail them in without having to leave their home. But generally, election laws vary by state. States are largely in control of what their election laws are going to be. And there's an obvious concern that some states won't do enough to make sure that everyone is able to safely cast a vote. And obviously, or maybe not obviously for people who are less familiar with the American context, the particular concern is that Republican-controlled states would purposely use stricter rules and deadlines to suppress the vote, right? And to suppress the mail-in vote in particular, which everyone suspected, and it has been the case that those votes are heavily Democratic. I mean, in general, the Republican Party has been quite open about the fact that they do better when fewer people vote. And so they've always been implicated in these kind of voter suppression schemes, and there's obvious concern that they can do the same thing here.
In this episode, where our initial plan was to focus is to focus primarily on the case of mail-in ballots and the decisions of some states and not other states to actually extend the voting deadline. And one thing we haven't mentioned explicitly is, well, okay, there's an increase in interest in voting by mail, but why is it especially challenging right now? Well, as we know, the system, you know, the vote counting systems themselves are overwhelmed by the increased demand. But in addition to that, the mail system itself has also been overwhelmed by the increased volume of people trying to vote by mail, as well as COVID in general, just increasing or creating challenges for efficient, you know, mail transportation.
And these are institutions, both the Postal Service and state election apparatus, which are generally, you know, experts say, underfunded and understaffed, and already they have a tough time every single year, and this is a particularly challenging one.
Right. So that is the backdrop for why there's the potential that you could then utilize these inefficiencies in the system to sort of manipulate outcomes by potentially changing the or having stricter mail-in ballot receipt standards for when the votes are actually received, to then thereby sort of undercount the votes that are coming in. I'm sure as all listeners maybe not, because there's some overseas listeners. One phenomena that is clear here, one pattern that's pretty important, is the fact that mail-in ballots are skew heavily towards the Democrats, and for multiple reasons, right? They are more likely to think that COVID is a serious problem, and therefore are more inclined to want to vote by mail rather than voting in person, which might subject you to greater risk of catching COVID. And then on top of that, Democrats are just more inclined to do mail-in ballots generally, even prior to this election. So all of that means that mail-in ballots are skewed more towards one party than the other, and that party happens to not be in control of many state legislatures, where the authority to set the standards for which votes will be counted or when votes have to be in to be counted those standards are set by the other party, the party that is not inclined to have its voters turn out in high numbers using mail-in ballots. Of course, that's not to say that there weren't a lot of Republicans who did mail-in voting, because of course there were, because the numbers, as you noted, were massively up. That's the backdrop of why there is the potential for, in some sense, manipulations of outcomes through stricter standards, and as you described it, as voter suppression.
Now, we've emphasized the importance of Pennsylvania here, but actually, and it's interesting, right, because Pennsylvania is a case where the deadline was permitted by the Supreme Court, but we're actually going to be focusing largely on the Wisconsin case where it wasn't permitted. There was an attempt to create a deadline by lower courts, and the Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. In part because I think our presumption probably is, our common sense position is that, like, I don't know, it's kind of crazy right now, and, like, you should do what you can to make sure people's votes are counted. So, like, I'm just kind of interested in what the arguments could be for for saying, no, sorry.
It's
the deadline matters.
Right. And the idea that somehow our democratic institutions depend on us imposing these, in some ways, sort of arbitrary standards. They're arbitrary in the sense that lots of states have different ones. No specific standard clearly matters. And you would think, given the obviousness of that, that in unusual circumstances like what we're experiencing, it would be ideal if we just counted.
Yeah, just change it up a little bit. You know, make it a little bit easier. So that's interesting. But the other reason is that it's very difficult to say much about the Pennsylvania case because the Supreme Court really didn't decide on it. They just kind of said, this is an interesting question, but we don't have time for it right now. This might be something worth revisiting in the future. Whereas in the Wisconsin case, we got quite a lot of detail and some actual argumentation.
Right. And I mean, the clear thing is there was basically a 4-4 split within the court in the Pennsylvania case. And so there wasn't a majority opinion. And so they effectively said, we're going to punt on this for now, which is why when we say there was a decision, it's effectively to just punt. And of course, that doesn't prevent them from taking up the issue again. And if things ended up turning on Pennsylvania, the outcome in Pennsylvania, then it's very possible that they will take up this issue again. And the decision that they had in Wisconsin seems to be a good, it's kind of indication of where the court might be leaning. And that's the other reason to think that it's worth paying attention to.
Yeah. Though there are some potential differences, which are
one could hope
technical. And we'll get there. We'll get there.
Yeah.
So let's start talking about the Wisconsin case, because that will be the focus here. The opinion, the majority opinion, was written by Kavanaugh, Justice Kavanaugh, our favorite. And there was a dissenting opinion from Elena Kagan, which we'll also discuss. But let me just explain kind of what happened in Wisconsin and how we got to the decision. So first, just a simple description of the relevant laws in Wisconsin. So in Wisconsin, they allowed people to request a ballot up until, I think, October 29th, which was a few days before the election. Cool. However, the law was that it's not that the ballot must be postmarked by election day. They must receive it by election day. And in part because of the things we talked about, the Postal Service was experiencing like 1 to 2 week delays. So the concern there is that a lot of people, you know, sent their ballot maybe kind of close to the election date, thinking that it would surely arrive in time by mail, but because of the delays, it wouldn't. So with this concern, a federal district court, in response to a complaint from the Democratic National Committee, ordered that the deadline for receiving mail-in ballots be extended to 6 days after the election. So it would just increase the number of ballots received that would get counted. This case then went to the Federal Appeals Court, which then rejected the order of the district court. So the appeals court says, no, you can't do this. And then finally, it goes to the Supreme Court, which decides in favor of the appeals court, effectively overturning this 6-day extension period. So this is what happened.
So the final outcome was, sorry, you have to have the, we have to receive the ballots by election day. The extension was removed, and only those ballots that were received by election day are actually now going to be counted. And I think one thing to be clear is at this point, Wisconsin has actually been called in favor of Biden, right? And I think the key thing to keep in mind is, as far as I know, they actually respected the court's decision. So this didn't end up making the difference as far as the outcome of the presidential election. The other thing to keep in mind, I think, for people as we're going through these things is, on the one hand, we can say like, oh, well, that ballot counted, but did it, we are going to continuously do this kind of counterfactual thing where we ask, did it make a difference for the presidential election? And that's all we're really asking, right? But it could have made a difference for other, you know, there are lots of other elections that are ongoing. And in all of these states where we're like, ah, well, it didn't make the, you might look at it and be like, ah, oh, it didn't make a difference in the presidential election. There are still all these other decisions that are being made that people have a right to participate in. And they, those may have actually been affected. And I think that we're going to be guilty of this throughout the episode. But I think it's something to flag as that doesn't mean it was okay. Right.
For sure. Okay. So you're right. So like we have this really weighty constitutional right to vote. Right. And so like, that's kind of interesting. So then what could be the arguments for saying that no, and we should keep in mind too, or be clear that, you know, the estimate was that, and we'll get to more details later, without this deadline, thousands of ballots wouldn't be counted. They would be sent and not counted. So this, you know, this is a lot of people potentially you're talking about. Okay, so why does Kavanaugh, in conjunction with Gorsuch and Roberts, why does he say that the district court cannot extend the deadline by 6 days? He gives three what he says are independent arguments. That's maybe something we'll discuss. But let's start with the first one. So the first one is just that the problem with what the district court did is that it changed state election laws too close to the election. And in general, that's not something that federal courts should do. Federal courts should not tinker with state election laws when there's an impending election. So in particular, he cites what he refers to and others refer to as the Purcell rule, which comes from a 2006 case, Purcell versus Gonzalez, which says that, and this is Kavanaugh's wording, federal courts ordinarily should not alter state election laws in the period close to an election. And so he's going to say, in this case, the district court made the change about 6 weeks before the election, and that's too close. So the obvious question is, why not? Why can federal courts not do this? I guess for Kavanaugh, there's really two reasons why. What I take to be the primary reason, and it's the one that Kagan considers as being relevant, and one that I think we can all appreciate, is that if you change the election laws close to an election, there's a real risk that you create confusion in the voters, and it undermines trust in the process, and this is bad. It might undermine voting in general. You want the rules to be clear ahead of time so everyone knows what they have to do, and tinkering at the end is thus dangerous to the process. So that, I think, is the primary reason why this Purcell rule is taken to be relevant. The other thing that Kavanaugh stresses that Kagan doesn't really take up is that he stresses the effects on the administration side as well.
Yep.
This could be confusing for the administrators of the election process, and it's, you know, it's a complicated process and it's difficult and they have to communicate any changes, blah, 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 blah. So in general, it's the reason why federal courts should not intervene close to an election are concerns about trust, perceptions of fairness, confusion, and then also the efficiency of the process.
And I would, yeah, and potentially fairness of the process. So why do we care about, why is it important for the administration to have clear, well-defined rules? Well, the court has a history of saying that under the Equal Protection Clause, counties and, you know, states have to have clear and, you know, consistent criteria for determining which votes count or not. Right. And it's for the sake of the fairness of the election.
So Kagan, in her dissent, basically says Kavanaugh's interpretation of this Purcell rule. I mean, she denies, first of all, that it should be called a Purcell rule. It's a Purcell caution, if you will. The rule is not just about the temporal proximity to the election. What the Purcell case, the lesson from that is that in general, when a federal court is considering making a change, in an election, in election rules close to an election, they have to take this risk for causing confusion into consideration. It is a real risk. And so they have to kind of weigh up the harms and the benefits and balance those with respect to the voting process. It's not a hard and fast rule which says you may not make any changes close to the election, but this is an important consideration you must take, that you must keep in mind, basically.
Yeah, the key thing here is that it's not as though the constitutional right to vote simply goes on holiday, right, as you approach the election, right? It's not like the courts can't come in and do anything, you know, have their hands completely tied and just allow state legislators to do whatever they want, right? Close to as an election approaches, right? So like maybe it's helpful to just think about a sort of an extreme case, right? So if a state was...
Tall people cannot vote in this election.
And it's an edict that comes down, you know, by the legislature 3 days before the election. It's not as though the court then has to say, oh, sorry, courts can't intervene once we get close to the election. We have to defer to...
Purcell, we're going to cause confusion. The tall people thought they couldn't vote, but now it turns out they can. They're going to be very confused.
Right. So it's clear it can't possibly be the case that the courts are completely bound by Purcell to simply always ignore any obstacles to people's right to vote and states doing things that might create obstacles that would ultimately violate people's rights to vote. It's simply that you have to weigh your concerns about whatever those obstacles are with the concern that by offering a ruling and changing the rules, the court might itself end up inflicting more harm on voters by creating distrust and disincentivizing voting, or by constructing new obstacles that come about as a result of the new rules that have been created, or, you know, any number of ways that one might undermine the equal, you know, protection of voters if they made the decisions. These all have to be weighed, you know, against whatever harms that they're trying to potentially, whatever violations of one's rights they're trying to protect.
Right. And obviously, you know, it's a consideration. But in a case where you're considering like this disenfranchisement of a huge number of people with no justification, then obviously those considerations will get, or the confusion, the Purcell considerations get trumped by the right to vote considerations. And so then the question for her is, and the question for us is, if that's the way to interpret Purcell, what do we say about the Wisconsin case? Is it the case that by extending the deadline for receiving ballots, we are likely to cause confusion and undermine trust and fairness in the election in Wisconsin?
So the funny thing is, we keep saying the phrase trust and confusion as though they're like this somehow lumped together as part of a principle. It strikes me that they're really two completely separate.
Wait a minute. When I get confused, I just stop trusting anyone.
We have to take those separately. One of the things that I guess one of the elephants in the room is there are lots of things that could cause failures of trust right now, right? There is a kind of conspiratorial mindset that has swept through the country, right? And so I do think the court could do just about anything, and that would be grounds for causing distrust for some people.
Seems right.
So I do wonder, is this meant to actually be reasonable grounds for distrust? That can't be it.
Maybe it's just a like... You know, courts shouldn't make things worse along these dimensions. They don't have to remedy it necessarily, but they shouldn't be responsible for the further undermining of trust.
Sure. I mean, these are things to certainly ascribe some value to. The courts want to foster as much trust in our institutions as they can. I wonder why we use why the phrase perceptions of fairness come up in these discussions a lot, because the other way to go is just be like, no, we actually care about whether or not the outcomes are fair, as opposed to the perceptions of fairness.
This comes up a little bit in the Kavanaugh discussion on some of the other points. I think when we talk about his third argument, it'll be really relevant. But I think the idea is like, yeah, fairness obviously is really important, but if people don't think it's fair, then the institutions get undermined whether they're fair or not. And so that is like a separate harm potentially for the institutions.
Right. So ultimately, we're just talking about, so one kind of concern that has to, the court has to consider is the way in which any ruling that they offer late in the game might hurt the institution that, in this case,
are already completely screwed for the non-court related reasons that you referred to before. Yes.
Hey, how can you hurt? Yeah. How can you hurt that?
I know, right? But so anyways, back to the deadline extension in Wisconsin. So we asked, so we're just going through Kagan's dissent here. She says, yes, well, you know, Purcell tells us we need to take into consideration the fact that we're making changes close to an election. We have to ask, in this particular case, is it likely to lead to voter confusion? And that is the thing that they focus on. No. Why not? It's not a in some ways, it doesn't change anything about voting, right? It's just a question of, you know, the state of Wisconsin is going to receive a crap ton of ballots. Some of them will come on election day. Some of them will come after. Some of them will come, you know, up to 6 days after. And the question for them is, which ones do we count or not?
Right.
That would seem to impose pretty minimal confusion on the part of voters. Yes, it is taxing for administrators. They have to make a change. They might have to work longer than they expected. So that is some kind of cost. It's going to take a bit longer, or it would. But presumably, the costs of that are relatively minimal compared to the costs of lots of people not having their votes counted at all.
It's useful to, I think it's possibly useful to compare this case to like the Purcell case, to just kind of get into the weeds of like what kind of confusion we were talking about, like what kind of confusion was at issue in the Purcell case versus this kind of confusion. And how that could potentially create an incentive to stay away from the polls, to use Kagan's words. Yeah. Because that, to me, is sort of the critical difference on her view, that in the Purcell case, it's clear that there was a kind of confusion that could actually make it so that some people decided, you know what, I guess I can't vote. Maybe I don't meet the standards to vote, so I won't. There's no point in, you know, going through the process since I'm not going to be allowed to vote anyway.
Yeah. Good news for you. I went down the Purcell rabbit hole this morning, so I am steeped in the opinion in the Purcell case.
All right.
All right. And the reason why I went down this rabbit hole is because there is a clear disagreement about how to interpret this case. Kavanaugh seems to think it gives you this really strict rule about intervening close to an election. Kagan says, no, it's about bearing in mind that, you know, court changes close to an election will have consequences and balancing those. So I wanted to go back to the original opinion and see what the heck was going on. But so, yeah, let's first describe the case. So this is Arizona 2006. The state of Arizona, the state legislature, has enacted a voter ID law. So voters have to have certain identification requirements in order to vote. I could say a lot more about that, but I won't. these kinds of things tend to raise red flags because it can be difficult for people to, you know, have the requisite identification. It at least makes it much harder for people to vote, right? These kinds of laws are enacted over concerns of voter fraud, which one thing we never mentioned is like the reason or the justification that Republicans give for their really strict voter laws and their apparent voter suppression is this obsession with the possibility of voter fraud. Donald Trump obviously is like chief voter fraud person, right? He leads the committee on concerns about voter fraud. All of the actual investigations into voter fraud in America suggest that it's basically non-existent. Anyways.
One podcast that I listened to said it's something along the line, like the probability that somebody commits voter fraud is actually less than the probability that you'll be struck by a meteor.
That's a good way to put it. So anyways, so Arizona's enacted this voter ID law. So various groups in Arizona, including, you know, Native American tribes and other people, bring this to the courts and say, you know, this is going to disenfranchise them. It's going to make them make it difficult for them to vote. All right. So they take it to the federal district court. And the district court says, no, sorry, we're not going to remove the voter ID law. And what will become relevant is that they don't give a lot of information at the time about that decision, but we'll get there. So then it goes to the appeals court, and the appeals court overturns the decision of the district court. So the appeals court actually orders that the voter ID law be removed. So this goes to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court decides in favor of the district court. So they actually say, and this is where the Purcell reasoning is meant to come from, so the Supreme Court says that the appeals court in this case was wrong to overturn the decision. And then Kavanaugh is going to say, because it was so close to an election, right? And so the federal appeals court shouldn't be involved in changing state election law that close to the election. Now, can I give like what actually happened there? I might have to read a big block of text here. Or do you have?
I have just like a very simple clarifying question first.
Sure.
Okay. So essentially, the final outcome of this was there is this voter ID law that was going to make it more challenging in order to be able to vote.
Yep.
The district court says no to that one.
Correct.
And the Supreme Court says, we agree. No, we are not going to. The final outcome is there is the stricter law, stricter voter ID law is not going to apply. We don't want to change it that close to an election and create confusion and make people think that.
No. It's the opposite. We're not going to remove the stricter law close to the election.
So we're keeping the stricter law.
We are. Yeah. So sorry. No. we're keeping the state legislature. We're keeping the state law.
Okay.
The district court initially said we can't remove that law. It was the appeals court that said, no, that law is no good, and overturns the law. And then the Supreme Court rules in favor of the district court and says the appeals court was in the wrong here. So the Supreme Court says we are keeping the strict voter ID law.
Okay. Because we don't want to create confusion and thereby dissuade people from trying to vote.
Yeah. So I guess in this case, it would be like, okay, you know, all right, family, we have to go out and get this voter ID thing. I don't know the details of this, right? We were making plans about how to do this. And then all of a sudden before the election, I don't remember how far ahead, we find out, oh, no, we actually don't need those. Maybe at this point, a certain segment of the population is like, well, who the fuck knows what we have to do? I'm sick of this shit.
I give up.
Fuck this.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess it's something like that. That's the Kavanaugh interpretation,
right,
of Purcell. Can I read a block of text from the Purcell opinion? I think it's helpful to go
sure.
through it
yep.
a little bit. Sure. So, because I don't think Kavanaugh's interpretation is right. From what I can tell, the Kagan one seems far more sensible. So keeping that complicated structure in mind, we have a voter ID law has been enacted, and Supreme Court eventually says, yes, we have to keep it because changing it could be costly. So here's what they actually say. This is the crucial paragraph in this. Faced with an application to enjoin operation of voter ID procedures just weeks before an election, the Court of Appeals, so the court that they think was in the wrong, was required to weigh, in addition to the harms attendant upon issuance or non-issuance of an injunction, so these are the harms that we've been talking about, the costs and benefits of overturning the law or not. In addition to that, they need to consider considerations specific to election cases and its own institutional procedures. That bit actually has not been talked about yet, but will be the crucial thing. So it goes on. Court orders affecting elections, especially conflicting orders, can themselves result in voter confusion and consequent incentive to remain away from the polls. Okay, we've talked about this. As an election draws closer, that risk will increase. True. So the Court of Appeals may have deemed this consideration to be grounds for prompt action. So I guess so far the idea is that The Court of Appeals tries to quickly remove the voter ID law because they know the closer it gets to the election, the more risky it is for them remove the voter ID law, increasing confusion. Okay. Furthermore, it might have given some weight to the possibility that the non-prevailing parties would want to seek in-bank review, which is something that would take a lot of time. And then it goes on. These considerations, however, cannot be controlling here. It was still necessary, as a procedural matter, for the Court of Appeals to give deference to the discretion of the district court. We find no indication that it did so, and we conclude that this was error. Okay, so the crucial thing is this last bit here, which shouldn't make sense yet. So the claim is that the Court of Appeals didn't give due deference to the discretion of the district court. The background here is that when the initial case gets taken to the district court, so the groups are complaining about this voter ID law, the district court says, no, the voter ID law will remain, but they didn't either have or make public all of their fact-finding concerning, you know, the prevalence of voter fraud and the costs of having the voter ID law, which is part of what they have to do in order to hear this case. So they didn't make that public when they made their decision. So the Court of Appeals overturns the district court's decision without having had the fact-finding stuff from the district court because it didn't exist yet. But as a procedural matter, the appeals court is required to do that. So since it couldn't have, as a procedural matter, the appeals court was in error. That is the Purcell case. And they go on to say, right, in this, I'm not going to read more of it. They go on to say that, yeah, we don't really have any, you know, decision like one way or the other as to how this should go. But there was this procedural error. So the appeals decision's no good. So I think Kagan is right to focus on the sort of balancing thing. Like one thing that's clear is like, yeah, it makes clear that this risk of changing things close to an election is a real thing. And you should take that seriously. But there's no indication that like this is the, you know, this is what determines the Purcell case or that this really strict Purcell rule comes out of this at all.
Yeah.
It's weird, right?
There's a lot. Yeah. Dear listeners, we're sorry. All right. This is probably the most in the weeds episode we've ever done.
That is correct. I went down the rabbit hole. Like, look,
now,
the upshot here is like, I don't know where you get the Purcell rule. Kagan's interpretation of it mostly follows the actual text and she quotes it, whereas Kavanaugh doesn't. That's all I got.
So okay, well, let's not even, I think we're philosophers. We don't have to worry about what actually the right, interpretation of precedent is. I think what you went through while it was in the weeds did actually, I mean, I think this conversation has helped me better understand some of the arguments in the Wisconsin case that I didn't fully appreciate at the time, in part because I hadn't fully appreciated how the justices were thinking of the way that confusion operates to disincentivize voting. And I think
I see.
I think I now have a much clearer picture of that thanks to this deep in the weeds dive that we've done. I think it could be summed up pretty simply, right? It's like you put it, like where yeah, you have a family. I was imagining some of, you know, you have friends, you know, and you're like.
Michael just pantomimed smoking a joint.
You voting tomorrow?
And passing it around. He passed it to me virtually.
You voting tomorrow? I think so. Do you have your ID? Do you have all the IDs that you need? Yeah. Well, you can do this. I can. Your other friend says, no, you can't. And then you just go back and forth until you're like, I don't fucking know. Fuck it. I'm not doing it.
This is stupid, man. Why vote anyways?
So it's that kind of just sort of the effect of having bad information out there and the frustration with that can be sufficient to discourage voters from voting.
For sure.
The reason I had asked about whether there was initially a strict law or not is because my initial intuition is, and what I thought the Purcell case would have turned on before you actually went into the weeds and explained it, is I would have thought that it would have turned on, so you have some law that you try to change that makes it harder for voters, right? And it's near the election, and the kind of confusion and challenges that would bring clearly would disincentivize voting. But in all of these cases, so in the case of the ID law, and in
any change whatsoever, whether it makes it harder,
right,
or
exactly easier. That's the key thing, yeah. Right? So in the Wisconsin case, because you can imagine, like, who on earth is gonna you can imagine the reply or the initial thought being, who on earth is harmed in the case where you just extend the voting deadline? The people who thought the deadline was earlier will have already voted if they were going to vote. And then by extending the deadline, the only thing that can happen is people who didn't know that they could vote are now going to learn that they could potentially vote and vote. Right? It's hard to, my initial thought when hearing this, the kind of reasoning that shows up in both the Kavanaugh and Kagan decisions, it's hard to wrap my head around how that confusion actually operates to disincentivize voting in these cases where, yeah, some people might have been confused, but if they were actually going to vote, that just means they would have done so ahead of time. And then I figured in the case of like ID laws, okay, there I can see being confused about what you need in order to be able to vote, that can discourage you, right? Because we've all been to the DMV, and it's a fucking nightmare.
Oh, baby. Oh, yeah. Come back later.
We've all had that.
I worked for some years at my dad and my uncle's woodworking shop thing, and they have this really crappy company van, and it needed something. I don't know if it needed like a license, registration renewal or something, and I had to go to the DMV, and they literally gave me nothing. I showed up at the DMV and they're like, are you kidding me? I think I ended up having to make two more trips that day back there.
I would imagine. Honestly, even...
What a nightmare.
Even in cases where you've thoroughly done the research and it's actually publicly available, in registering to vote here, I had to go through the process of figuring out... We just moved and I had to prove... I had to prove that I live here. Proving that I, own the place is insufficient. I actually have to prove that I right. reside here. So like the mortgage, that's insufficient.
You have to install a camera and send them video.
That wouldn't work either.
Wouldn't work.
But it was actually a rather difficult process. And then like you read the descriptions of stuff and you're like, all right, does this fall into this category, this documentation we have? I see how that kind of confusion dissuades people because it's a profoundly frustrating thing and we've all had the experience of showing up and not being able to do it. It does seem to me like deadlines, particularly when you're extending deadlines, I can't think of a comparable experience I've had where the confusion disincentivizes.
I think this is why Kavanaugh stresses the lives of the administrators in this. But he doesn't say they're going to get confused, because what's confusing about, oh, we have to count these ballots instead? He has a paragraph where he talks about how complicated the process is. You know, you have the election officials and the counters, and there has to be communication between them. And then the voters, you have to communicate things to the voters. And oh my God, this is so difficult. And so like the conclusion is like, it's annoying for the administrators if you extend the deadline. But like, yeah, the concerns about confusion, hard to imagine how that could be the case. Unless someone's like, I mailed in my ballot on the 29th and I'm confident that it's not going to be counted because the postal system is delayed. Now they're telling me it will be counted. Well, now I'm confused.
Right, exactly. No, that's it. That's the thing that's different in this case, is that the only people that I can imagine being harmed are the people who already acted ahead of time. But there's no reason...
They voted.
Right, exactly. That to me was going into the weeds was at least helpful for me to kind of understand what the basis of this argument is, and also to clear up this, to bring into light the basic disanalogy that I still don't fully see how you work through. I will say, in the case of the administrators, there are, I can see some complexities to it. Again, I'm thinking more of Pennsylvania than I am of Wisconsin, but like in the case of Pennsylvania, you know, it depends on if you have a rule that says it has to be postmarked by a period or if it has to be received by a period. If you are a vote counter, you might have to figure out, like, is there a postmark date on this? Is there a receipt date? Like, where are those? Do we actually always have that data? I think in some cases in Pennsylvania, like, the rule was supposed to be if it's postmarked by a certain date or if it isn't postmarked at all. But if it's postmarked after, then it doesn't, right? So, like, it's a, those criteria could get a little complex. And I can see an issue of, like, we need to have consistent rules and guidelines. For the, you know, equal protection reasoning that the court has used in the past to say, like, we need to have a consistent standard everywhere to determine whether or not these votes are going to count or not.
I want to raise two quick things about Purcell, but and before we should move on and never talk about Purcell again.
Okay.
One, Kavanaugh's own characterization of the rule is this. Again, this is a quote. Federal courts ordinarily should not alter state election laws in the period close to an election. Okay. If ever there were non-ordinary circumstances, I think we're in them. But that very phrasing admits of exceptions. It suggests that there are extraordinary circumstances.
I don't see... Right.
So it's strange to me that he interprets it as this really strict rule.
So I want to just stay on that for a second because this is actually something that's bothered me too. That not the ordinary part, but just there has to be exceptions.
Yeah.
So... I was trying to think through, like, what happens in other cases where, so, I mean, things could have been easily reversed too, as far as like party interest and stuff, right? So you have all these mail-in ballots. Suppose that you have, Snowmageddon, right? Like on the day of the election. And coming from Maine, that's what I imagine as like the natural catastrophe is the state has an unbelievable early season snow that just kind of shuts the state down. And nobody can actually leave their house. Now, lots of votes have been cast, right? Because you have lots of votes that have actually been received. And as we know, those votes would primarily favor one party over the other because Democrats are more likely to vote by mail. Suppose that at that point, the legislature, which is, you know, democratically controlled, says, you know what? That's it. We're not changing anything. You have to vote today. If you want to vote in person, it's got to be today. Even though the natural disaster makes it so that literally nobody can do that. And that's what the legislature says. Could the courts at that point say, come in and say, no, this is clearly an effort by the legislature to suppress votes? I don't see how you could possibly think anything else if that were to happen.
Yet, given what materials we've seen from these opinions, it would seem like no, especially if the state courts, which they say, and this is relevant to the Pennsylvania case, more weeds, don't need to get into it, but you know, Roberts, in talking about the Wisconsin cases, what's different in the Pennsylvania case is it was a decision by the state court to extend the deadline, and the state court is in charge of interpreting the state constitution, and this is within their power, something like that. So if the state legislature and the state courts said no, tough shit, then given everything I've seen, I don't know what grounds the Supreme or federal courts would have for intervening.
And that just seems like madness.
It does seem like madness.
So I think that's one of the things here. It's that there are two different questions, right? There is sort of like, what are the constitutional sort of procedural rules that we have in place And that's ultimately the question that the court is asking itself. Then there's the basic common sense philosophical questions like, what world do you want to live in?
It's really interesting. I mean, because the reason why, you know, the courts are like this, the reason that they cite over and over, as we've talked about, is they're really, really concerned about buy-in into the institutions and trust in the institutions. And they will not, they don't want to do anything that will slightly undermine the institutions, usually, even if, you know, it'd be rectifying sort of an obvious injustice.
But the obvious question
is interesting.
So the obvious thing is, though, like, okay, take the Snowmageddon case again. Is it really the case that, like, if it's blatant that the Democratic legislature, if, like, all the polls say they're going to lose, right, they're going to lose control of the legislature, that they're going to, you know, have all of their candidates voted out of office if they hold the election, if the election were to proceed as normal, but Snowmageddon prevents people from voting in person, everybody would recognize the conflict of interest, and they would recognize that the institution was being abused to keep people in power. I don't see how the courts can, I don't see how you can reason in those cases where it's patently obvious that the legislature is abusing its power by not acting in those cases to retain its power, that think that the perception and trust in the institution would thereby be fostered by simply allowing the legislature to do that.
I mean, this is another response Kagan has to another part of Kavanaugh's argument, which, you know, in some ways is like Kavanaugh echoes what, I don't know, Republican strategists in the Trump administration have said, which is like, in a lot of cases, in a lot of the states, in states where the deadline for receiving mail-in ballots is a few days after the election, you're going to have this horrible scenario where Trump appears to be ahead on election night and everyone says, ah, okay, I know who the winner is. But then after the election night, more votes get counted and the result apparently changes after election day. This will lead to the destruction of our institutions and total chaos. And right, Kavanaugh literally says a version of this and points to the perceptions of fairness, right? And he uses the language that, like, the results will be flipped afterwards. And in a footnote, and it's funny, it's only a footnote, Kagan's like, bruh, the idea of flipping doesn't make sense until all the votes are counted. But you get this weird thing, which is like, because people have this irrational expectation that the result be in on election night or shortly thereafter, they will go crazy and riot and destroy democracy if that doesn't happen. And so we shouldn't count all the votes.
Right. And additionally, and the other thing in this case that makes it so absurd is we know, and we knew going into election night, that exactly the scenario that Kavanaugh was describing as being one that would undermine people's trust in the institution was inevitable if we just counted all the votes that weren't even at issue, right? Because we knew that we were not going to have counted all of the Pennsylvania votes on election night if we only counted those votes that had been received by election day. Like, we knew that there was just no way that was going to happen. So that scenario was inevitable regardless of whether or not they accepted the 3-day grace period that Pennsylvania wanted to add.
Not to mention the fact that Fox News and the Trump administration literally causes this unrest by, like, saying that it is a reason why you should be upset if this happens, right? And just...
Right, well,
basically,
exactly.
To the extent that people do get pissed off, it is because of that. They're intentionally exploiting this.
There's a much simpler solution. Just don't foster distrust in our institutions. And
yeah. Okay, the one other quick Purcell thing before we never talk about it again. There's this one part, right, because there's this concern, right? Like, so in the Wisconsin case, Purcell says, district court, you shouldn't have extended the deadline so close to the election. So they did that 6 weeks ahead of time, right? But then the concern is like, well, wouldn't Purcell say that it's even worse for the Supreme Court to reverse it because you've made another change leading to more confusion even closer to the election? And he goes, well, this turns Purcell on its head. A federal court may correct a mistake from another federal court. This does not violate Purcell. Interestingly, I take it he's actually responding to Ginsburg in her decision or her dissenting opinion in the, it was the Wisconsin Democratic primary in April. She used Purcell to make this kind of complaint. Well, the change has already been made. If we make another change, that's going to make it even worse. I'm kind of with, like, if what matters is confusion, then I think Ginsburg's right. And Purcell cuts that way, too. It can be turned on its head, right? If the courts shouldn't be causing confusion, then
the more
they shouldn't cause more confusion in undoing a mistake, right?
At the very least, you'd think that you have to weigh the harms.
You're exactly. You at the very least, you'd think you have to be rational, right? And you actually weigh up things rather than just saying, this is a rule. It has no exceptions. It's a rule. All right. No more fucking Purcell. Okay, so that's the Purcell argument from Kavanaugh. The second argument was this. I don't know if we want to spend a lot of time on this, but he says the district court in the Wisconsin case misapprehends the limited role of federal courts in COVID-19 cases. So in other words, what he's saying is, in general, the courts should defer to the state legislatures with respect to determining what are reasonable risks that people can take in elections and in general, right, determining what is safe and what it isn't, right? That should be left to the state legislatures, not the federal courts, because the state legislatures, A, are, you know, beholden to the electorate. They can be voted out or whatever. And there's also a presumption that they have better expertise or better access to the facts, and they'll make responsible decisions.
Right. Or they...
And other cases have decided that this is the precedent.
Right. Or at the very least, that they have access to... They can form commissions and, you know, have interview experts. They may not have expertise themselves, but they have they're better positioned to fact find.
Yeah. Again, I mean, this argument to me, it's not one that Kagan focuses on a ton. I mean, what she does point out is that, like, well, the state legislature during the April primary deemed it necessary to have an extension of the deadline then, I think. And by reasonable metrics, the pandemic in Wisconsin is 20 times worse now. Like, it's really bad in Wisconsin right now. It's something that, you know, we didn't emphasize. Yeah, I mean, so, well, maybe there should be, ordinarily, there should be a presumption in favor of the state legislatures. Sometimes, maybe not.
So maybe there should be a presumption. And this is, again, there's two questions, right? There is, what kind of procedural rules do we currently have? Right. And there's a sense in which that's what the court's trying to figure out. What are the procedural rules? And it is the case that we have established precedent and that there will be a deference to state legislatures. At this point, though, I can't help but ask, but is that the world we want to live in? For the following obvious reason that, and this is something that Kagan brings up in her dissent, though she's not responding specifically to this particular argument, but one of the things she emphasizes is the obvious fact that there are conflicts of interest between the state legislatures and the establishment of fair voting rules that aren't biased in favor of one party over another.
I mean, see gerrymandering, obviously. Exactly. It's not election rules per se, but that's
I mean, gerrymandering is exactly right. And there's a sense in which this kind of establishment of particular procedural rules can have the exact same effects as gerrymandering, particularly when you know, I mean, like some of the procedural rules that we've talked about. So when are the deadlines? Where are the drop-off ballot, you know, boxes in the Texas case? Those have exactly the same kind of effects as gerrymandering, in that you can predictably create a bias in favor of one party over another simply by messing around with those procedural rules. Like in the Dropbox case, it's literally, it's kind of the geographic gerrymandering that we talked about in the gerrymandering episode, where some areas are simply geographically larger than others, which means that there's a, this is something that came up on On Point podcast episode that I listened to, where the authors were pointing out that, like, these rules in Texas, because of the geography in Texas, make it so that, like, literally some people have to drive, you know, hundreds of miles to drop off their ballot, whereas other people can do so in, you know, no time at all. And those different burdens create different probabilities of particular demographics voting. And it's not accidental the way that the choices are made regarding where to put those things. And the case of voting deadlines are very much analogous to that, where if you know that one group of people are much more likely to vote in one particular way than another, then just by messing with those procedural rules, you can influence outcomes. And obviously, legislatures, the elected officials, are exactly the people who have an incentive to fuck around with that and to manipulate it. So, well, obviously, I'm not, there may not be an argument against the court as far as the, you know, there may not be a coherent argument that can be made against the interpretation of the precedent. But at the very least, one can ask, yeah, but is that really the world we want to live in? And one might ask, like, well, what are the alternatives? Well, the alternative, you know, and you might think, well, the courts don't have any expertise in this either. And so how are the courts going to make these decisions? And the obvious response there is, yeah, fair enough. So let's do it like every other fucking country. And let's have an independent voting commission that makes these decisions, that, and where you don't have the, these, you know, perverse incentives interfering with the ability to just create reasonable, fair procedures. There are options. And so
we will continue to ignore them. That in that particular case, like, there's no chance, right? Because it's part of the state's, like, sacred, you know, powers and rights. This is how this stuff is talked about.
And it's, I mean, it is built into the Constitution as far as, you know, the appointing electorates and, you know, our delegates and all that. So, yeah, it's certainly not going to change, but you still have to ask yourself why, and is this really what we want?
Yeah, so I think this is a good spot to dovetail off to the third argument, which I think is really the primary argument for Kavanaugh. I think the Purcell stuff is kind of silly. The COVID thing is kind of silly. And, like, there's no way, you know, he's got these three separate arguments. Does he think that any one of them is sufficient to show that the courts shouldn't intervene? It better not be the COVID thing, right? Because then again, state legislatures could do whatever the heck they want, more or less, and the courts would be forced to defer. Like, it can't mean that. So, but the third thing is, right? And so, Michael, you were like, well, you know, state legislatures know who votes by, who's more likely to vote by mail, who's more likely to vote in person. And Kavanaugh's going to say, so what he says here is, the third argument is that the court didn't sufficiently appreciate the significance of election deadlines. So Kavanaugh's going to say, all those people who mail in their ballots, they don't have to. Wisconsin gives you all kinds of ways to mail in your ballot. In fact, if you request a ballot on the 29th and get it, you know, November 1st, you can drive it to a drop-off location. I mean, you can, you know, send it in earlier. You can vote early in person if you want. There are all kinds of ways to do it. And so what he says is basically this. Any election has to have some deadline or other, right? There's concerns about, you know, efficiency, but as a practical fact of the matter, obviously there has to be some deadline. Provided the deadline is reasonable, and he's going to say in Wisconsin it is reasonable because there are all these other ways to vote, there cannot be a problem. What he says is he reasons from the fact that the deadline is reasonable because of all these alternatives, because it's, there are many ways to vote, that therefore the deadline does not disenfranchise anyone. And therefore, there is no constitutional problem, something like that.
So
what say you, Michael? I mean, but, like, look, because, like, part of the idea is, like, there are deadlines, and sometimes people are negligent and irresponsible, and we don't think that that's, you know, an illegitimate disenfranchising of them if they just miss the deadline in other kinds of cases. So why is this different?
So it's hard to not go back to the at least parts of the discussion for argument two, which is there's this thing called COVID. I don't know if you've heard about it, but one of the questions I had after going through that argument is how much of this just turned, and I think actually in Kagan and her response also has kind of this reply in mind of like, how much is this line of argument just dependent on the assumption that COVID really isn't that bad? And that the various systems that the mail-in, these various voting options depend on aren't affected by COVID and sort of the weird circumstances that everybody's in, right? So as far as being able to mail in your ballot, sort of not being tardy and mailing in your ballot on time, right? The question is like, okay, when I'm going through the voting process, I start with from a certain epistemic position, right? I have certain information about how long it's going to take to receive mail, how long it's going to take to send mail. Now we know that with COVID, those conditions are regularly changing. How long it takes, right? I might have thought back in April that I didn't have to, you know, request ballots right away and that I could send out my ballot later because, you know, mail is running very quickly and it wouldn't really take any time.
It's local. It's going to take a day or two.
Right, exactly.
At most, right?
Yeah. And so I might think I have right up until near the deadline at the very least until I actually have to send out my ballot. Now, for lots of people, you know, if the way you described as potential delays that people are experiencing, if it's like 2 weeks, right, I might have had a reasonable expectation that 2 or 3 days under normal circumstances are sufficient. But then it turns out that it takes 14 days due to the system being overwhelmed by the increased number of mail-in voters, which just is a unique thing that people, since it's unprecedented, really couldn't project out and foresee. And then in addition, due to COVID, just things are taking longer as well. So between those things, there's a kind of unpredictable nature to how long it's going to take. And so the one question is like, well, if I'm negligent, then fine. I wasn't sort of unfairly treated, right? If my vote's not counted. But to what degree do we have to predict the unforeseeable or the unlikely? How much do we have to anticipate unlikely events in order to not be considered negligent? Presumably, I mean, like, suppose that normally the mail takes 2 days and you mail out your ballots and then some kind of natural disaster occurs and, you know, your mail is going to now take a month. Well, would the court really in those kinds of cases say, no, sorry, you were tardy. You could have mailed it in a month before?
Yeah, so it's interesting. So, I mean, one of the concerns that Kavanaugh says is like, look, Wisconsin's deadlines are not abnormal. And so if there's a problem with Wisconsin, there's a problem with 30 other states. And Kagan says, she seems to disagree with that. And she says, Wisconsin is kind of unique. And what's crucial is that it meets these three conditions. One, COVID is particularly bad in Wisconsin. Arguably, it's the worst state right now with respect to COVID. It's very close. Number two is the understaffed election offices and the slow delivery system. But then number three is the late deadline for mailing ballots and for applying for them. So what's interesting is like, it seems like Kagan's saying, if, and I don't know what the deadline is for mailing ballots, it could be election day, but it kind of just doesn't matter. Because they're not going to, if they're the deadline for receiving them is election day, obviously they're not going to get them the same day. So she's kind of saying like if the deadline for mail, say they had to be postmarked by October 15th, which would give you, you know, a little more than 2 weeks to get it before election day, then she wouldn't necessarily have a problem with it if that was the, you know, the rule that was publicized ahead of time and everyone was, familiar with it, because that's much less likely to cause confusion than in the current case where you can mail it really late. Like, there's no, you know, mailing deadline, but it just won't be counted, which is kind of interesting. And the thing that she emphasizes is you have a situation where someone follows the rules completely, right? They can, the rules are such that they allow people to apparently meet all of the deadlines except for the receipt deadline, and so their vote won't be counted. So that everything, of course, once they put it in the mail, it's out of their hands. It's outside of their power at this point, right? So if the rules make it the case that lots of people act within the rules as far as it's possible for them and their vote still isn't counted, then it's a problem.
I mean, what you just said, what you just described was that she basically thinks that if you, it's a, really a problem if you do everything by the book. If an individual does everything by the book and by all reasonable expectation has done things such that their vote would be counted, right? So if you mail out your ballot in a time where you normally would expect that they would arrive and be counted, but due to unforeseeable circumstances by you, you know, acts of God or whatever interfere, well, then you are, in a sense, disenfranchised, right? Intuitively to me, that has to be right, right? Like, again, take Snowmageddon, but invert it, you know, with mail-in ballots can't be can't arrive due to some, you know, unforeseen thing for an extra couple of weeks.
So in some sense, you actually cast your vote. You're able to vote, but it's not counted.
Right.
Which obviously is a crucial, I mean, maybe there's a metaphysical question as to whether it's voting if it isn't counted, but yeah.
Like, there has to be some kind of room for that. Now, the argument's supposed to be that we did not sufficiently appreciate the significance of election deadlines, and the Kavanaugh's view is basically, look, if you're negligent or tardy or whatever, sorry, tough shit, we need to have established hard deadlines in order to run elections. And so it's not disenfranchising, his views, you know, his reply is simply, look, it's not disenfranchising people if they fail to meet whatever deadlines we set. And the obvious reply is, okay, that's certainly true when circumstances are normal. If the information is available to me that mail will not arrive within 3 days of, you know, whatever the deadline is, and the deadline is it must be received within 3 days, then fine. You know, I'm not disenfranchised if I'm not proactive and I don't, like, go through the process in time. That's essentially what I take to be the reply here. The problem is, what happens when it's not foreseeable, right? And I think Kagan's reply to that is, these circumstances are significantly different because they're not foreseeable, right? The other thing she points out is that, you know, what would the court have said had the deadline been pushed back in April, right? They would have said that's way too premature because we can't possibly know that there will actually be a problem. We have to wait until we're in a situation where we can actually evaluate the information about the mailing times and form reasonable expectations about whether or not mail-in ballots will be received or not. So in the end, it just seems like the Kavanaugh claims that he actually accepts all of the, this is the other part of the argument that we haven't gone over yet, but he claims that he accepts all of the empirical facts that were presented by the lower courts as part, and that were used by the lower courts as part of their decision, right? Where he...
Kind of. That'll be a complication in a second, but yeah. I mean, so he's... Yeah.
I mean, well, he says... I mean, he says Kagan disagrees, but he says that he accepts the basic empirical facts. COVID's bad. It's a real health risk. You know, mail is slow. Those sorts of things.
Yeah.
The obvious reply, though, is okay, but those facts are make it so that people could have had a reasonable expectation that their vote would have counted and that they followed all the rules and yet be wrong about that. And
yeah, legally, it's not spelled out that that's the rule, but philosophically, it seems like that would be a good starting point for,
right,
you know, determining what your election rules are going to be. And it's why, yeah, it would probably be better if, you know, the state, knowing that the postal system is going to be backed up, if they had an earlier postmark deadline so that you no longer could have the, you know, reasonable expectation that you could submit it a week before and have it still be counted.
Right.
Right? It's interesting. By making it stricter, you could actually kind of solve some of these problems.
Right.
Not always, but in that particular way. Now, one thing that's really interesting here, and the reason why I said there's a complication with respect to Kavanaugh's accepting the facts. One of the things that the district court says that Kagan emphasizes is the district court in, you know, ordering the extension, they do a bunch of fact-finding stuff, right? And they estimate that without the extension, something like 100,000 ballots that are cast won't be counted. Now, Kavanaugh just says this is not a fact, it's a prediction. So he doesn't really accept this estimate as good evidence of anything. And it's interesting what he does with it, because as far as I can tell, his argument goes like this. So as I said before, for Kavanaugh, the deadline is reasonable. It's a reasonable deadline because Wisconsin gives you all these different ways to cast your vote. And so if you don't cast your vote, you're just failing to meet a reasonable deadline. You're negligent, right? And then he says, reasonable elections don't disenfranchise anyone, so no one's disenfranchised in Wisconsin. And then, so the question is, like, what does he do with this 100,000 figure, 100,000 ballots? He either has to say, well, we should be skeptical of that estimate, which he kind of does.
Yep.
Or, well, the deadline's reasonable. Well, and part of this would be like, the deadline's reasonable and people aren't that negligent, so it will be much lower than that. It's fine. Or, yeah, it's huge, but that just means that that many people are negligent.
Right.
Whereas Kagan, on the other hand, does the rational thing and says, wait a second, if there's 100,000 ballots that are going to be cast that aren't counted, maybe this is evidence that the deadlines and the rules are not reasonable, right? Kavanaugh has already independently a priori established that the deadline's reasonable. And so that kind of evidence he can't actually consider as evidence of reasonableness or not, which is insanity. I just thought that part was hilarious.
Hilarious until you have to live with the consequences.
Yeah. That seems right. And also just his rejection of estimates. Like, sure, it is an estimate, and so it's not, it doesn't have the same status as a historical fact or something, but like, bro, we got to make plans on the best evidence we have. I don't know what else you want.
Right. Well, he does a couple of things, right? Because he also tries to cast doubt on the way in which the estimates were generated. Right. So he says, look, you formulate that projection based on what you would have expected had the deadline for the primary not been moved. And his claim is that when you move a deadline, of course, you then increase the chances that people will vote later. So the more people will vote if the deadline's later. That seems plausible. But then he claims that that's exactly how the estimates basically assume that were formulated in a manner that just assume that, you know, that effect didn't occur. I don't know what I can't remember if Kagan had a reply to that or not.
Well, one of the things she says is like, okay, suppose it's half. That's 50,000.
Right.
Which, by the way, just to give other figures, I think she cites, I seem to recall a figure of like the number of ballots that were cast but not counted in the 2016 election. It was like in the hundreds or something. I'm not remembering that, though. I'm not confident. In any case, there's high confidence that a very unusual number, usually high number of ballots will be cast and not counted if the deadline isn't extended.
Which seems fairly plausible, just given what we know about the mail system. Again, if it's one of those facts that we're accepting, that the mail is running significantly longer, how would that not be the case? That it would at least be a significant number.
Yeah. And at this point, you know, you move away from the legal question and then you get to the philosophical question. And you're like, okay, Kavanaugh, suppose the election rules are reasonable. Like, don't you want still that your rules accommodate people and make sure that votes that are cast are counted? Like, why not just make that allowance, right? why not just have, like, even if a deadline is reasonable, it could still be more restrictive than it needs to be, right? And like, and if you care about democracy and people being able to vote, yeah, why not just have a slightly less restrictive, reasonable deadline? Oh, because it'll undermine all the institutions, right? I forgot about that part.
Yep.
And of course, the reply is, hey, you know what else undermines the institutions? When people can't vote and they cast votes and they don't get counted.
Especially when they do everything right and
yeah,
they have a reasonable expectation that they will be counted.
And you know what the other thing, too, we should note is, right, suppose a week before the deadline, the election day in Wisconsin, you mail out your ballot. And you're like, I'm going to give this a week because, you know, postal system's backed up. And then you find out, oh, it's actually behind 2 weeks on election day or sometime before that. You're like, oh, shit, my vote's not going to be counted. You can't then go and cast an in-person vote. That's against state law to do that because you already
received a
ballot. Exactly.
You'd be double voting. Right. So
at that point, you're screwed.
Right.
That seems especially stupid, problematic.
Yep. So the other thing that we haven't said explicitly that Kagan brought out, that Kagan points out in reply to this, that I think is really important, is given that, I guess in some ways this is actually a reply to the Purcell stuff.
Hmm. Oh no, I vowed never to hear another word about that.
So obviously it's important to have some kind of deadline because you need to count votes and you need to have new officials and you need to have an orderly process and you need to have it standardized for equal, you know, protection reasons, all of that. And look, if people are given clear guidelines for what they need to do in order to vote on time, and they form reasonable, clear expectations of when that means they need to vote by and all of that, and they fail to, you know, meet those basic deadlines, fine. But the reality is that the information and the situation can rapidly change, right? And I think this is the other thing that Kagan ends up emphasizing in her reply. Initially, I thought of it as a reply to the first argument, the Purcell stuff, but in some ways, it's just as much a reply to this argument. That the reality is, what constitutes a reasonable expectation that your vote will be counted and that you're doing everything according to like the election guidelines very much depend on contextual facts about how the virus is, you know, how your state is managing the virus at a particular time, how your mailing system is handling its, you know, demand at a time, and those things evolve. And one of the responses to the Purcell stuff is, well, hey, one of the criteria built into the Purcell rule is that it can't be close to the election deadline. And one of Kagan's responses to that is, but hold on a second. Sometimes you simply cannot do things too early because you just don't have the information. You have to be responsive to the facts as they change. And similarly, what it means for a voter to be, you know, sort of reasonable and have a reasonable expectation that they can actually meet whatever the voting expectations are can also change as the facts about, you know, COVID and the mail system change. And that's the thing that it just seems like the Kavanaugh argument here doesn't in any way deal with is the fact that as the situation on the ground evolves and as your expectations, what were once reasonable expectations are undermined by, you know, worsening conditions, how can it be that a person, that the individual voters bear responsibility for that, right, and are negligent? And I guess that, I mean, is it the case? Maybe it's that that Kavanaugh and the majority really would just take the line that, look, regardless, even if, you know, some natural disaster was to prevent the votes from being received on time, still too bad. Those votes don't count. They didn't meet whatever the guidelines were. I don't know. It's hard for me to think that they would actually believe that.
I could see Kavanaugh taking that line, but I would bet justices like Roberts wouldn't. So I wouldn't be surprised if Kavanaugh took that line, but I don't know if a majority would. But on that note, I think we should probably wrap this incredibly technical discussion up. I did just peek on the New York Times in 538. Still don't know the result. Maybe by the time people are listening to this on Friday.
I think we're supposed to.
Or whenever you listen to it.
I think that we should at least know if it's going to be some awful contested thing by the time they...
Yeah. Let's hope this podcast is only somewhat interesting and not super relevant.
And
important
let's,
going
let's
forward.
Hope it's utterly navel gazing and unnecessary, and
that's the way we like it.
Yeah.
All right, well, I don't know, what do I say? Good luck, everyone.
I got nothing. I don't know.
No, I got nothing. All right, well, thanks for the chat, Michael.
Yep.
We'll
same, Toby.
Catch you next time.
All right, see ya.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Badlands Politics and Philosophy Podcast. If you're enjoying the podcast, you can help it grow by subscribing and by giving it a good rating or a review. And don't forget to check out our website, badlandsphilosophy.com, where you can find a list of citations for every episode and access written content that we post there regularly. If you want to get in touch with us, you can do that through our website, and you can also find us on Twitter at the Badlands Pod. Thanks again for listening.